coming up in this episode.
I think Taliban had a good year last year, and they're trying to have a good one this year, sir. Right now, I believe that the enemy is surging right now.
Secretary of Defense James Mattis told the Senate Armed Services Committee the Taliban are trying to make a comeback in Afghanistan. And Target USA has learned there are some very specific reasons why they're able to do that.
Thousands of well-trained fighters from the Afghan-Pakistan border region who used to be part of Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups such as Lashkar-e-Taiba or the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, who have integrated over the last 2 years into the Taliban fold, and therefore had an influx of real military fighting experience.
So how is the U.S. military going to deal with that? An in-depth examination of the U.S. strategy for Afghanistan, plus a global assessment of the terror problem from the UN's ISIL, Al-Qaeda Taliban Monitoring Team Coordinator, Hans Jacob Schindler, coming up on this edition of Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile
capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
D.C. is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green. The Pentagon issued a statement recently saying that essentially it has the authority to add several thousand more troops to those already fighting in Afghanistan. But a key question is, how are those troops going to be used along with the others in a war that's stretched out over 16 years? Senator John McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, had a bit of a conversation with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis about that, and that conversation reflected frustration from both of them.
First conversation that you and I had was about a strategy for Afghanistan. We're now 6 months into this administration. We still haven't got a strategy for Afghanistan. It makes it hard for us to support you when we don't have a strategy. We know what the strategy was for the last 8 years. Don't lose. That hasn't worked. Just mentioned in my opening statement, we just lost three brave Americans. When can we expect the Congress of the United States to get a strategy for Afghanistan that is a departure from the last 8 years, which is don't lose?
I believe by mid-July, we'll be able to brief you in detail, sir. We're putting it together now, and there are actions being taken to make certain that we don't pay a price for the delay. But we recognize the need for urgency, and your criticism is fair, sir.
Well, I'm a great admirer of yours, Mr. Secretary, and so are those men and women who have had the honor of serving under you. But we just can't keep going like this. You can't expect us to fulfill the three requirements that you gave: funding increase, pass a budget, present a stable budget, if you don't give us a strategy. And I hope you understand that I'm not criticizing you, but there are problems within this administration. I was confident that within the first 30 to 60 days, we would have a strategy from which to start working. So all I can tell you is that unless we get a strategy from you, you're going to get a strategy from us. And I appreciate our wisdom and knowledge and information and all of the great things, with the exception of some to my left here. But the fact is, it's not our job. It's not our job. It's yours. And I have to tell you, the frustration that I feel is obviously palpable, because it's hard for us to act when you don't give us a strategy, which then leads to policy, which then leads to authorization, which is our job. So I hope you understand that we're going to start getting more vocal in our criticism of not having a strategy for Afghanistan. Do you agree that we're not winning in Afghanistan?
Sir, I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now, and we will correct this as soon as possible. I believe the three things we are asking for stand on their own merit, however, as we look more broadly at the protection of the country. But in no way does that relieve me of the need to deliver that strategy to you, sir.
I thank you, General, and I understand very well, as do members of this committee.
Just days after that exchange between Senator McCain and Secretary Mattis, and lots of speculation about how many troops the Pentagon would be sending and when, Chief Pentagon spokesman Dana White released a statement saying, quote, "Secretary Mattis has made no decision on a troop increase for Afghanistan. As he said throughout the week in testimony, the revised Afghan strategy will be presented to the president for his approval in the coming weeks. The president has delegated force management authority for Afghanistan to the secretary. The secretary will continue to follow the president's guidance on our overall strategy. Any decisions about troop numbers will be made only after consultation with the interagency, the Afghan government, NATO allies, and coalition partners." The situation in Afghanistan is a very complicated one. As I mentioned, the U.S. has been involved there for 16 years, since 2001, just after the attacks in the U.S. on 9/11. So for some perspective on why the Taliban is surging and why it's such a complicated situation, we spoke with Hans Jacob Schindler, who was the coordinator for the UN Security Council's Al-Qaeda Taliban Monitoring Team, which has been renamed the ISIL Al-Qaeda Taliban Monitoring Team recently, about that situation. Mr. Schindler, can we start off first by recognizing the change that's taken place over the years? This team used to be called the Al-Qaeda Taliban Monitoring Team, but clearly the presence of the Islamic State organization has dictated a change. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We would not characterize this as a fundamental change, as we see ISIL, as the Security Council calls it, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, not as a fundamentally new phenomenon, but as an additional phenomenon in the wider Al-Qaeda ideology. It's important to note that there is no fundamental ideological difference between Al-Qaeda and ISIL as far as their core beliefs is concerned. Both organizations want to found a caliphate, so it's only a question of timing and sequencing, which is one of the main differences. Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden had been quite clear on this, sees the establishment of the caliphate as a project for the next generation, while ISIL under al-Baghdadi clearly said the time is now to establish the caliphate. So we have a dispute over the sequencing, now or the next generation. And of course, we have a pure power play, a difference on who should lead, Mr. Baghdadi or Mr. Zawahiri. Other than that, there is really no fundamental difference between both organizations. And we can see, especially in the last 1.5 years around the globe, that Al-Qaeda and ISIL networks are willing to support each other. The only real conflicts that we've seen between Al-Qaeda loyal groups and ISIL loyal groups were at the very beginning in Syria, where Al-Nusra Front of the Levant and ISIL did fight each other, and continuing in Somalia, where the Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Shabaab is trying to eliminate its competitor, ISIL.
Okay.
However, other areas in the world, we've seen great cooperation, unfortunately, between both networks.
Okay. Well said. The U.S. Secretary of Defense said not long ago just that the Taliban is surging again. Does your research find that?
Absolutely. We have seen in the last two fighting seasons, so the one in 2015 and then particularly the one in 2016, and the expectations are that this fighting season in 2017 is going to be very similar, that the Taliban have increased military capabilities. In our assessment, primarily or fundamentally caused by an influx of thousands of well-trained fighters from the Afghan-Pakistan border region who used to be part of Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups such as Lashkar-e-Taiba or the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, who have integrated over the last 2 years into the Taliban fold and therefore had an influx of real military fighting experience. And we've seen in the last two fighting seasons, and there is no indication that this is going to be any different this time, that the Taliban were able to coordinate their military activities across the country, simultaneously attacking provincial capitals such as Kunduz or in the north and Lashkar Gah in the south, and thereby really stretching the capabilities both of the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces as well as the international forces in Afghanistan.
What do you make of reports that Russia has been funding the Taliban, or at least it appears as though some elements of the Russian government have been providing funding? Do you see the same thing?
Well, we've always highlighted in our reports over the years that there is a problem with the inflow of weapons, ammunition, and material into Afghanistan from all corners of the country, the north, the south, the east and the west. So this is not a fundamentally new problem that arms and ammunition flow into Afghanistan. However, it is a problem that this flow has never really been curbed or slowed down in the last few years.
I see. So you don't see anything out of the ordinary regarding reports that Russia has increased supposedly its support or help to this organization?
I would not be able to comment on particular actions that member states may or may not have been taking in the past. But clearly, there is a worry that I personally have that the region may lose faith in the ability of Kabul to win this fight. And that some groups within countries or some power centers within member states may try to hedge their bets. Certainly, we've seen quite a lot of involvement in Afghanistan in the last 2 years compared to previous times.
Let me just get your view on the general standing of the Islamic State group right now. We know that it's about to lose Mosul. Raqqa is about to come under attack. What have you found in your last report, which I believe came out several months ago, and up until now, if you have any new information, about the status of the organization and its posture?
On the one hand, we need to go away from seeing ISIL simply as an Iraq-Syria problem. ISIL has now groups that have declared loyalty to it all around the globe, in West Africa, in East Africa, in Northern Africa, in Southeast Asia, in South Asia. So we do have a quite variety of groups that actively feel themselves as part of the ISIL phenomenon. So in Iraq and Syria, I absolutely agree with you. ISIL had significant military setbacks over the last 2 years. In Afghanistan, it is under pressure. In Libya, it is under pressure. However, ISIL is still able to purposefully send out personnel out of Iraq and Syria to relocate to other regions, which is, of course, a major concern of ours, as well as send out finances, not only to groups that work with it, but apparently, according to several of our interlocutors, which are usually member states and member states' intelligence organizations, into areas where there is no ISIL activity. So apparently investing money into the illicit economy for the day after, which, of course, demonstrates that ISIL is conscious of the fact that it may not be able to hold militarily out in Iraq and Syria for a very long time, and therefore is now preparing to transform itself into a more global network, which, of course, will spread the threat outwards from the conflict zone to other regions.
How do you think they will try to run this global operation if they don't have a physical base to do it? Can they do all of this via the Internet, or is this essentially a scenario where the damage has been done? They have gotten their ideology out there in the last 3 years to the degree that they've got the following that they need to no longer be or to have a physical presence.
Look, I mean, as we had already at the beginning of the military operations outlined, we are seeing a sort of repeat of 2002 when Al-Qaeda lost its physical base. That in no way inhibited al-Qaeda from organizing its network for many years afterwards. Therefore, what we're seeing right now, and a physical space doesn't need to be control over entire cities. Wherever there is weak government, terror groups can flourish. They don't need to hold large swathes of terror of territory in order to organize a global network. Therefore, the military operations are absolutely necessary. It's unacceptable that a terror organization holds cities and terrorizes civilians and does unspeakable things, including slave trade and the barbaric behavior they displayed. However, as far as a terror network is concerned, holding cities and villages is not a core necessity. You can organize this without holding a city. And of course, the internet and this what ISIL calls the cyber caliphate is an incredibly helpful instrument to the group. And they do have expanded over the last few years their presence.
Mr. Schindler, you know, thanks again for doing this. You know, reading through your report, I noticed there were some bullet points that I sort of pulled out. One of them was the problem that you foresee of returning Islamic State foreign fighters and intercepted fighters. Explain to us how you see that problem playing out.
It falls into several categories. I mean, number one, the returnees, which we define as individuals go back from the conflict zone to the country where they came from. Those fall broadly into three threat categories. Number one, the returnees who left the conflict zone being thoroughly disenchanted with both ISIL as well as terrorism as an ideology. There is a chance for member states to reintegrate those into society in the long run. Obviously, there needs to be a judicial review of whether they've committed any crimes, and they should definitely be punished for that. But there is a chance that those will be reintegrating into society. The second category is also very clear. These are the ones who come back to their own countries to conduct terror attacks. And we've seen this in Europe in particular in the past few months quite strikingly. And the third category is the most difficult one, is the ones that are discontented from ISIL as an organization, but not at all discontented from terrorism as an ideology. So they are willing to join any other new terror group that may be coming up or rejoining al-Qaeda networks. So these are very dangerous individuals, but difficult to grapple from a legal perspective, because they absolutely claim that they are no longer part of ISIL. The other category of individuals that are concerning us are the ones who purposefully do not come back to their home countries, those who want to go and continue to fight, relocate to different areas, and therefore exacerbating quite critical security situations already around the globe. And the last weeks, if you look at the situation in Southeast Asia, actually, unfortunately, confirms the predictions that we made in our report in April, that this is an area where there is an enhanced risk by fighters coming out of Syria and Iraq going back to the conflict zone there in Southeast Asia, by Southeast Asians traveling to join groups in Southeast Asia, and the fact that there is going to be quite a few senior and long-standing al-Qaeda operatives that were arrested about 10 years ago on terrorism charges after the Bali bombings, having finished their prison sentence and unfortunately not being really radicalized, going back into society and potentially revitalizing al-Qaeda networks in the region.
You know, I was reading that report, and you did, you did predict some very stunning developments that have taken place, and that's a part of the reason why you do the hard and difficult work that you're supposed to do anyway. So it is absolutely correct that you predicted much of what we're seeing. What about the situation in the United Kingdom right now? What do you make of that?
I think the situation in the United Kingdom is fundamentally similar to the situation in the rest of Europe. We never had numbers of individuals traveling to the conflict zone of the scale that we've seen in the last few years. Therefore, part of the risk profile of each country is also in a certain way connected to the amount of people that have gone. ISIL, once it became under pressure in Iraq and Syria, purposefully put more emphasis on external attacks and formed language-specific and country-specific groups. So Germans talking to sympathizers in Germany, French to sympathizers in France and Brits to sympathizers in Great Britain, trying to not only inspire but encourage and help them to conduct attacks. So the fact that Britain has a high number of foreign terrorist fighters means ISIL has more opportunities in that country than maybe in countries with a much lower number of foreign fighters. But it's while it's true that Britain, France, and Germany are publicly named as priority targets for ISIL in Europe, it's not the only countries that are under threat. You've seen the very tragic attack in April in Sweden, that ISIL takes opportunities wherever they arise, rather than being discriminatory and says only those three countries.
Mm-hmm. And much of what they do now is inspired as opposed to directed. Is that correct? Would you agree with that?
We actually talk about three categories. So directed, the showcase for a directed attack are the Brussels, or the showcases are the attacks in Brussels and Paris, where ISIL core, in a very classical al-Qaeda sense, as it was done by al-Qaeda up until 9/11, ISIL core was very much involved in the planning, very much involved in the organization, sent fighters, sent money, made sure that the operation was going ahead smoothly, and had a continuous feedback loop between Paris, Brussels, and Syria and Iraq, ISIL core. That's a directed attack. We've so far, since Paris and Brussels, not seen any other example where it was done in such great detail. However, purely inspired attacks are for us attacks where an individual wakes up in the morning without any prior connections to organizational connections to ISIL and conducts an attack. This is also fairly rare. Therefore, the third category that we're talking about is enabled attacks, where there are connections to ISIL core, where ISIL core gives information, target packages, ideas, IED designs, or sends small amounts of money in order to enable the individual in their home country to conduct this attack. And most of the attacks in Europe in the last few months, who sometimes were portrayed as lone actors or lone wolves attacks, turned out to be of this kind, that it was not someone individually deciding to do something, but there was indeed prior contact, at least to the ISIL propaganda machine, to upload their video where they claim responsibility for the attack.
Mr. Schindler, one of the things they've been able to do very well is some very innovative types of weapons. And one of the most recent pieces that I've heard about is this supposed laptop bomb. The ability for them to not pioneer the technology, because I believe Ibrahim al-Assiri and that group from AQAP were among the first to engage in that kind of innovative type of bomb, but they the Islamic State group, I'm told, is getting much better at that kind of technology, which supposedly inspired the laptop ban that we've been hearing about in the U.S. and the U.K. for some time now. What's your point of view on their capability to do something like the laptop bomb?
Look, I mean, AQAP, without a shadow of a doubt, and Mr. Assiri in particular, has been the most innovative IED and bomb maker of the entire Al-Qaeda ISIL network. I don't think there's anyone as capable as he is. The real problem is that this is never group-specific. Specific designs proliferate very quickly. If an IED works very well in Iraq, within a few months, we'll see this used in other conflict zones, mostly first in Afghanistan. So if there is a design out there that actually works, you will see documentaries about this in the terrorist networks. For example, you saw the construction of the bomb that brought down the Russian airliner that took off in the Sinai a while back. Being with pictures and descriptions immediately distributed in terrorist fora. So the problem is not who develops it. The problem is once it's developed, it can be used by anyone else.
And one of the things you also talk about in your report is the financial decline for the Islamic State group. And you refer to something called a crisis budget. Explain what that is.
I mean, without a shadow of a doubt, ISIL was and unfortunately until now continues to be the terror organization with the largest income every month in a very, very long time. We haven't seen any numbers like this with Al-Qaeda, honestly speaking, ever. However, the military operations, of course, which liberate areas, which damaged the oil infrastructure that ISIL is holding in Syria, has results on the income of ISIL. So if you don't hold Ramadi, you cannot extort the economy of Ramadi. If the oil fields are severely damaged and production of oil goes down, you simply sell less oil, which incidentally is the reason why there is no longer an issue of ISIL selling oil across the borders in Syria. It's at the moment a purely internal market within Syria where ISIL sells its oil. So it's getting less. However, one thing that we are going to highlight in our upcoming report is that it's often forgotten that if you don't hold Ramadi, you cannot extort Ramadi, but you also don't have to run Ramadi, i.e. you don't have to invest money to keep electricity provision intact or basic water and sanitation issues intact. So while there is less income, there are also significantly less costs. Our best estimate at the moment is that we've gone down from a few hundred million potentially a month at the very beginning, at the biggest expansion of ISIL of income, to tens of millions. However, that also means we have a much, much less burn rate of ISIL. And we see that on the one hand, ISIL is irregularly paying its fighters, and some fighters have taken on side jobs in inverted commas to substitute for the lack of pay. But we do not see any issue with arms and ammunition procurement of ISIL. Apparently, there is still enough money there. And ISIL sending out money to its affiliates fairly regularly through a fairly well-developed network of money exchange houses, hawaladars, as well as money couriers around the world. And as I said previously, investing money in areas where there are no ISIL cells, at least for now, apparently in preparing for the day after. So there is enough there. Terrorism is not an inherently expensive endeavor. Terror attacks like 9/11 cost just over $100,000. Paris and Brussels will have come in as costs much lower than this. Manchester is a question of a few hundred dollars. So it's small sums that enable a terror organization that is determined and patient to perpetrate horrendous attacks around the world.
Fascinating analysis of your report. The day after, I heard you mention that. And I would like to jump into that briefly before we let you go, because I know you have some much more important things to do. But I do appreciate you sharing some of this information with us and our listeners. The day after, what do you think the day after looks like? And when does the day after start?
Well, the day after is when ISIL doesn't hold a sufficient or a significant amount of territories in either in Iraq or in the Syrian Arab Republic anymore. But that will mean, that not necessarily mean, that there is no more ISIL in Iraq and Syria. Don't forget, the predecessor organization of ISIL was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who survived, you know, very much reduced, of course, in numbers, but survived even the American surge, essentially. In 2009. So there will be remnants of ISIL. And one of the big risks is that now that areas get liberated, Ramadi, Fallujah, hopefully very soon Mosul, there will be a lot of stabilization and reconstruction money flowing into these areas, while there may still be ISIL cells. So what we have highlighted in a briefing to the Security Council yesterday, as well as we will highlight in our report at the end of the month, is that needs to be a great vigilance of member states of what happens with their money once they pump it into these newly liberated areas to prevent ISIL cells that will definitely still continue. And you've seen after the liberation of Ramadi and Fallujah, there were still suicide bomb attacks in those cities.
So, are we talking
to take care to take advantage of this?
Are we talking about insurgencies?
Not insurgencies, but terror organizations. Mm-hmm. I mean, Al Qaeda in Iraq was a terror organization that perpetrated terror attack. It wasn't at the scale of an insurgency at the end, but it was able to perpetrate attacks. And if there is a lot of money getting pumped into a depleted war economy now, this liquidity could serve to finance Al-Qaeda cells around the world, because we have seen that there is an established network which ISIL already uses to send money around the world to its cells.
Fascinating. Mr. Schindler, this has been very good. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today, and I look forward to another opportunity to talk to you once your next report is done. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today, and have a good day.
All right. All the best.
Thank you.
Hans Jacob Schindler, coordinator for the ISIL, Al-Qaeda, Taliban monitoring team for the UN Security Council. The key topic today, what will the U.S.-Afghan strategy be? It's supposed to come out sometime in July of 2017, and we'll keep you posted. That's it for this episode. Coming up on our next program, whether it's terrorism, anarchists, cyber criminals, nation states, intelligence, or the U.S.'s own counterintelligence drama that's playing out in the Congress. Join us on Target USA for the latest. Thank you for spending some time with us, and please visit us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at TUSA Podcast. That's one word, Tango, Uniform, Sierra, Alpha Podcast. And let me know what you think at jgreen@wtop.com. That's one word, J, the color green, at wtop.com. That's Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa .com. I'm JJ Green. And this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
Here I'm walking through a field and I'm thinking about a girl just a few years younger than me that was stabbed to death.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America, and each one is called a cold case.
She said, "I think my dad could be responsible. I think he killed them."
These are some of those rare cases.
Cold Case Files, the podcast. Don't miss a moment. Subscribe now on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or at PodcastOne.com. And don't forget to watch or DVR Cold Case Files, the TV show, every Thursday at 10 on A&E.